This is Jeff Spittler, A Tale of Two Kingdoms, number 60, March 3rd, 2002, Raising the Highlanders. Okay, last week, last week we finished up in 1675, for those of you who haven't been here for a while, so... We covered several attempts that were either half-hearted and or Erastian in nature at reconciling the more well-behaved of the ejected ministers. One attempt was put forth by Robert Leighton, the Bishop of Dunblane and Archbishop of Glasgow, and was referred to as the Accommodation. However, he was unable to convince even the indulged ministers of its merits. Another attempt was made by the Scottish Parliament in the Second Indulgence. Ministers were assigned by name to various parishes. This had the effect of, at least for many of those who had otherwise been content to minister in their quietly in their parishes, this had the effect of forcing their hands, and so they had to, by not taking up their assignments, it was as if they'd made a positive act of disobedience. Along with that attempt, as always with this carrot and stick approach, the Parliament also passed a number of acts that increased the persecution of the Covenanters. Despite this, the number of field conventicles increased. In fact, it would continue increasing right up until about the end of today's class. In about 1678 or 1679 was the high point. And sometimes as many as 8,000 and 10,000 in attendance. And we'll talk about a little bit about one later today that had 14,000 in attendance. The rise in field conventicles led to some minor skirmishes between the Covenanters and the King's soldiers, and as described by Alexander Shields, for the most part these were very minor because the soldiers backed down when there was a superior force of arms. Also, we started to see various meetings of field presbyteries and the like, representing, say, an alternative church government to the established church. In the nature of the case, it was always highly secretive. Then in 1675, the Privy Council came up with a new method for dealing with outlaws who refused to appear in court. They issued these so-called letters of intercommuning, which forbade, under severe penalties, even capital, harboring or supplying with food or intelligence, or basically from communicating with any of the outlaws, proclaimed outlaws. And anyone who did that could be charged with being art and part of a conspiracy and hence could be sentenced to the same fate, which was in many cases execution. So, okay, well, on the 1st of March 1676, a new wave of persecution began, with the Privy Council issuing a proclamation against conventicles. You get this, reading this, there's always this sense of, deja vu or whatever. Here, you know, it just seems like they keep issuing these proclamations and so on, and a lot of the terms are very similar, but you'll see in each case they've added a few more things, so it's not completely redundant. In this case, they ordered the arrest of all ministers who didn't attend public worship with their families, fines against landowners when conventicles had been held on their property, rewards for informers, fines for magistrates who weren't sufficiently aggressive in cleaning up this conventicle problem. Let's see, they ordered a census of all who had taken the oaths of allegiance and supremacy, and special courts were commissioned to see that those laws were executed in every shire. Sent out these special commissions that went out and summoned landowners and ministers in the West and questioned them as to what their dealings with the intercommune had been. And then some of these people refusing to declare an oath or to declare on oath were held as having confessed and sent to prison for months till their friends paid the fines. Another star chamber of sorts was set up in July of 1676 with a royal commission establishing a committee of public affairs made up again of the usual suspects, the two archbishops and a number of the officers of state, and any three would form a quorum, and as usual it had unlimited powers. So Archbishop Sharp was the vice chair of the committee. Charles himself, was annoyed by the writings and support provided by this group of expatriates in Holland. We've mentioned some of them before, Robert McWard and John Brown of Wamfray, who are both ministers who'd been exiled. They both wrote substantial polemical works and pamphlets and books and pamphlets and those sorts of things. And also Colonel James Wallace, who'd been the Covenanter commander at William Green. Fortunately for them, the Dutch government refused their request, refused Charles's request. Let's see, in May of 1676, some 50 or 60 ejected ministers met secretly in Edinburgh for about a week's time. They transacted a typical sort of church court business regarding preachers and correspondence with the disunited portions of the church. And their minutes later fell into the government's hands when when the clerk of the meeting, Alexander Forrester, was arrested. They had another convention in the beginning of 1677, again in Edinburgh. And here we start to see the first cracks in the unity of the ejected ministers. Well, maybe not the first cracks, but maybe over this particular issue. Obviously, there had been some division, and some had taken the indulgence before. But the wedge issue here was the relationship of the field preachers to the ministers who'd taken one of the indulgences. While all the parties at the meeting agreed it was sinful to have taken the indulgences, or taken one of the indulgences, there were more diverse views as to how they should relate to those ministers who had taken it. The more extreme group, which included John Wellwood and Richard Cameron, and those of you who've read any covenanting literature probably have come across Richard Cameron, would have been two of the ministers there, that they publicly preached against the indulgence and against indulged ministers, and against hearing indulged ministers. In Maurice Grant's biography of Richard Cameron, he gives a pretty good summary of the issues, and let me just read it a little bit of length here. Wellwood had carefully thought through such issues as obedience to rulers, the right of popular resistance, and the relative responsibilities of church and state. From a close study of Scripture and the writings of the Reformers, he had developed a high view of the spiritual independence of the church and its freedom from state domination. This, of course, was what lay at the heart of the dispute between the nonconforming Presbyterians and the government. But in Wellwood's thinking, it assumed a particularly highly developed form. Wellwood formed the conviction that any action carried out in obedience to the state in its claims and pretensions over the church was an act of disloyalty to Christ as the church's head. While others may have been prepared to accept this as a principle, Wellwood pressed it to its logical, practical conclusion. This found expression in the view, which he was the first to propagate publicly, that those ministers who had accepted the government's indulgences had in doing so recognized the king's supremacy, and by virtue of that fact they were disobedient to Christ and had forfeited the right to a hearing. The more moderate view was held by a number of the, say, leading field preachers, by Welsh, Dixon, Semple, Blackadder, There were others who took a different view. The indulgence, they pointed out, had been a direct exercise of the king's authority. It had been a reflection of the right which he claimed to regulate the affairs of the church. As such, it was inconsistent with the Presbyterian principles and with the authority of Christ as the church's head. This was the position held by the leading field preachers, such as Welsh, Dixon, Semple, Blackadder. There was, of course, common ground between this position and that taken up by Wellwood and later by Cameron. But there was one essential difference. For the leading field preachers, attitudes to the indulgence were basically a matter of conscience. While they could not accept it for themselves, they were not prepared to condemn those whose consciences allowed them to do so. Objectively, they argued, acceptance of the indulgence could not be regarded as sinful until it had been condemned as such by a free General Assembly. In furtherance of this policy, they made it their practice not to touch on the indulgence in their preaching, nor to reflect it in any way on those who'd accepted it. Their duty, as they saw it, was to preach the gospel, and they did not want to introduce any note which would cause controversy or mar the success of the gospel. Okay.
So those were sort of the two different views, and a little bit later, I think Grant has a pretty insightful interpretation of the situation. The overall position then by the latter part of 1677 was one of gathering tension with the prospect of open conflict a very real possibility. This state of affairs was viewed by the moderate Presbyterians with great alarm. It seemed to them that the government was seeking an excuse for, or could be provoked into, a new wave of persecution, and that the Presbyterian testimony of the church as a whole was under threat. Their response, perhaps predictably, was to close ranks in the common cause. Differences of policy were seen as subservient to the overriding need for unity. In this critical state of affairs, what mattered most of all was that the church should show a united front. No other way, it was argued, could it now hope to survive. There was, of course, nothing new in all this. The same pragmatic spirit had been in evidence some 30 years before, when the country as a whole had been under threat from Cromwell. Then, the prevailing party, the Resolutioners, had counseled the policy of united action against the common enemy, irrespective of party. So it was now. Cast in the role of the Resolutioners were the majority of the non-complying ministers, including some of the leading field preachers. And as the aim of the Resolutioners had been to enlist the aid of those disaffected from the covenant, so these ministers now sought to court those who had accepted the indulgence. Once again, the need for external unity was to take priority, and expediency was to triumph over principle. The new policy duly manifests itself in practice. A meeting was held at which it was agreed that the ministers who had accepted the indulgence should be invited to preach alongside their non-complying brethren, while the latter would be given access to their pulpits. At the same time, steps were to be taken to silence any opposition to the indulgence on the part of the younger preachers. Up till now, Wellwood had been virtually a lone voice, but there were already signs that others were ready to follow in his footsteps. To forestall this, it was agreed that those presenting themselves for license should in future be required to give a promise not to preach on any matters which might create division, by which, of course, the indulgence was primarily intended. All the non-complying ministers were strictly enjoined to enforce these requirements when licensing young men to preach. Turns out when Richard Cameron was ordained, this was one of the issues, and he told them exactly where he stood on it, but this hadn't quite crystallized completely yet. But later it was to be a source of tension between him and many of the more well-known field preachers. Okay, so later in the month of January 1677, James Fraser Bray, a well-known field preacher, was captured at a private house in Edinburgh during family worship. He was examined by the Privy Council and transported to the Bass Rock on the 1st of February. His experiences, as recorded, show a very painful picture of prison life on the Bass. Petty tyrannies, bad food, and worse water. Oatmeal mixed with foul water or melted snow and dry fish. Vindictive usage, gifts stolen, warders blaspheming in order to irritate, debauching the female servants and blaming the pious prisoners, and other horrors. And along with him at the same time, there were at least nine ministers and, a certain number of other lay covenanters. It's not exactly clear how many, or not clear to me anyways. Let's see. So another large conventicle at Eckford, just north of Jedburgh, in later in 1677. And for those of you in coming to the denomination, have wondered about our practice of interviewing guests who might wish to commune with us prior to. Prior to taking communion, back then they were even more serious about it, and they issued tokens. So you had to, that was their way of knowing that you had passed the qualifications, and had exactly how they came up with this. But since they had so many people taking communion, they had these tokens that they would give out. So if we ever get a lot bigger, we might have to have communion tokens. And, if you're a member in good standing, you'll get yours or something. And if you're a visitor, when you've been interviewed and passed, then you can get this token and take communion.
Let's see. But still, if you haven't heard the description of one of these, it's kind of interesting. Blackadder and Welsh, accompanied by their bodyguard, marched about on their rousing mission. The former left a graphic description of an immense conventicle at Eckford and Teviotdale, where Welsh, Riddle, Dixon, Ray, and he officiated. "It is a pity to mutilate the exquisite story by an epitomized paraphrase." And see, that's what this Hewison is saying. So I thought, well, if I just paraphrase it, that would be, you know, yet another mutilation. So I'll at least give you exactly his epitomized paraphrase. "A multitude from all quarters swarmed onto a mead through which the Widadder flows. On preparation day Saturday, tokens were given to intending communicants. On Sabbath morn, three tables covered with linen cloths bore the communion cups and elements. A bright sun glorified a cloudless blue sky. The slopes around were clustered with over 3,000 believers waiting their turn to partake of the holy food. Though the God of Jacob was still the refuge, these hunted Christians had a fence of steel in the hands of horsemen round the feast, sentinels on the hilltops, and mounted scouts patrolling the vicinity. They expected the rash young Earl of Home and the Berwick militia to keep Home's threat to ride in and quote, make their horses drink the communion wine, trample the sacred elements underfoot. Aristocratic elders served the tables. Dixon's theme was, 'The Lord will provide.' 'Neither shall the covenant of my peace be removed,' was Blackadder's consoling subject next day. In such inspiring circumstances, the rapturous host saw heaven's king reflected in the beauty of holiness upon them. And as each night they retired to their various resting places guarded by armed men, they experienced a sense of divine power. And camping round about them, their earthly ruler was forgotten." Actually, in some of these, they had so many communicants and it took so long to serve that they divided people up, and somebody was preaching to one group while another group was actually taking communion. So, let's see. Conventicle held in Girvan on the 21st of October, 1677, with five preachers, including Welsh, attracted 7,000 people, with 2,000 taking communion. And according to spies at a large conventicle held that fall in Mabel, a great many swords were sold because it was determined that the people should rise if they were further provoked. That was comes from the calendar of state papers or whatever. It's official, you know, government document. So coincidentally, it was dated exactly 300 years before I got my driver's license, you know, just to the day. I'll have to ponder that one for a while. Okay, still in October, even though the persecution was in some respects increased, in October of 1677, some of the ministers on the Bass Rock were released, subject to some conditions. Alexander Payden was offered banishment with the clause that if he ever returned, he will have admitted his guilt in the 1616 Pentland Rising and be punished accordingly. So, I guess apparently he refused to agree to those terms, and he actually just got transported from the Bass Rock to the Edinburgh toll booth, the prison there, which I'm guessing wouldn't have necessarily been that much nicer quarters, but at least it would have been easier for your friends to provide food and so on. He was imprisoned until December 1678, and then he was ordered to be transported to the plantations in America. It's rumored to have said that the ship hasn't been built yet that will take me to America. And despotic governments then weren't as efficient as they are now. They sent him off by ship. He was supposed to be transferred at Gravesend port near London on the Thames. He was supposed to be transferred to another ship, but when the other captain found out that his cargo of convicts was actually a cargo of Christians who, you know, he refused to take him, and they just were like released and wandered off. So he made his way back to Scotland. The same month, a minor incident occurred, which, when blown out of proportion, was used to drum up demand for new persecution measures. John Balfour of Kinloch, in the parish of Colesey, which would distinguish it from all the other Kinlochs that are in Scotland, was a field preacher and a, quote, squat, squint-eyed, fierce-looking man known as Burley. He was the brother-in-law of David Haxton, whom some of you who have read Fair Sunshine may recognize as one of the short biographies is on him. Balfour was meeting with Alexander Hamilton of Kinkle and Robert Hamilton. Robert Hamilton later was to be a military leader of sorts of the Covenanters in such places as Drumclog and Bothwell Bridge. And their meeting was interrupted by a dozen soldiers under the command of one Captain Carstairs. And one of his Irish soldiers took a shot at the party, and they shot back. The account just says bringing him down. I don't know if it was fatal or not. And this scared off the rest of these soldiers. This was followed by rumors that the Westland Whigs were about to revolt. And Lauderdale misrepresented the situation to the king to propose that the Highlanders be sent in. Charles put Scotland under martial law in December 1677, authorized the mustering of English troops in the north of England and in the north of Ireland. The day after Christmas 1677, he signed the Commission for Raising the Highlanders. That was the name of the document. Now, to those of us sitting here in Oklahoma in 2002, it's probably a little difficult to really viscerally understand just what this would mean. It's basically an invasion by barbarians who carried off everything imaginable. And I actually found a little contemporary account of what they carried off. But starting in Stirling on the 24th of January, 1678, Hewison says the gales swept over southwest Scotland like a flood and bore away whatever they fancied. Every church was converted into an armory for discarded weapons, and the graveyard into a pound for commandeered horses. Every cupboard was often searched and every sheaf devoured. Okay, so I'll read at length a contemporary account. This is by Alexander Shields in A Hind Let Loose. So he says, they brought down from the wild highlands a host of savages upon the western shires, more terrible than Turks or Tartars, men who feared not God nor regarded man, and being also poor, pitiful skybalds. Even my Oxford English Dictionary, the big thick volume, didn't have skybalds in it. And a Google search only revealed three occurrences on the internet, one of which was this. But somebody here says it's, some writer inserted, contemptible fellows. Well, somehow I have a feeling it was a little stronger than that, but maybe not. They thought they had come to a brave world to waste and destroy a plentiful country, which they resolved before they left it to make as bare as their own. This hellish crew was adduced to a work of reformation like the French conversions, to press a band of conformity wherein every subscriber is bound for himself, and all under him, wife, children, servants, tenants, to frequent their parish churches, and never to go to these meetings, the field conventicles, nor reset harbor, right, nor entertain any that went, but to inform against, pursue, and deliver up all vagrant preachers, as they call them, to trial and judgment. Which they prosecuted with that rigor and restless, boundless rage that the children then unborn and their pitiful mothers do lament the memory of that day for the loss of their fathers and husbands. Many houses and families then were left desolate in a winter flight. Many lost their cattle and horses, and some, in seeking to recover them, lost their lives by the sword of these burrios, or hangmen. So that it was too evident, both by what orders was given the severity of prosecuting, and the expressions of some great ones since, that nothing less than the utter ruin and desolation of these shires was consulted and concluded, and that expedition at that time calculated for that end. For what else can be imagined could induce to the raising 10,000 or 11,000 barbarous savages, the joining them to the standing forces, and with such cruel orders the directing them all to the west, where there was not one person moving the finger against them. Neither could they pretend any quarrel if it was not the faithfulness of the people there in their covenanted religion, and their hopelessness of complying to their popish and tyrannical designs. And therefore no course so feasible as to destroy them, so for dispatching thereof, order is given forth, that whosoever refuseth to subscribe that hell-hatched bond must instantly have 10, 20, 30, 40, or more or fewer, according to his condition, as he is poorer or richer, of these new reformers sent to him, in other words, the Highlanders, to lie not only upon free quarters to eat up and destroy what they pleased, but also, for the more speedy expedition, ordered to take a sixpence for each common soldier a day, and the officers more according to their degrees, and so to remain till either the bond was subscribed or all destroyed,
Nor was these trustees deficient to further their purposes in prosecuting their orders, who, coming to their quarters, used ordinarily to produce a billgate for near to as many more as came, and for these absences they must have double money, because their landlord was not burdened with their maintenance. And where that was refused would take the readiest goods, and if anything remained not destroyed or plundered at their removing, which was not transportable, rather than the owner should get any good of it, they would in some places set fire to it, as they did with the corn stacks. It would require several great volumes to record the many instances of horrid barbarities, bloods, and villainies of that wicked expedition. So that what by free quarterings, exactions, robberies, thefts, plunderings, and other acts of violence and cruelty, many places were ruined almost to desolation. All which the faithful chose rather to suffer than to sin in complying. And albeit their oppression was exceedingly lamentable, and their loss great, yet that of the compliers was greater and sadder, who lost the good conscience in yielding to them and compounding with them. Okay, so Highlanders were sent home in February, and they were loaded down with all the booty they could carry. And the historian Wadrow, who is writing not at the time, but he interviewed a lot of the people who had been there, said, "One would have thought they had been at the sacking of some besieged town by their baggage and luggage. They were loaded with spoil. They carried away a great many horses, and no small quantity of goods out of merchant shops, whole webs of linen and woolen cloth, some silver plate bearing the names and arms of gentlemen. You should have seen them with loads of bedclothes, carpets, men's and women's wearing clothes, pots, pans, gridiron, shoes, and other furniture, whereof they had pillaged the country." If you, any of you have, you might sometime read this novel by John Galt, written in the 1800s, called Ringen Galesi. And if I remember right, it's been several years since I've read it. But one of the things that struck me was this, you know, this novel, this was this account of the carrying off all this stuff right down to shoes and things that, you know, we couldn't imagine somebody, you know, carrying off. They were just taking everything. So, or maybe I shouldn't say that. I once knew a guy who lived in Chicago, and he was burglarized by somebody who apparently brought a moving van in, and they said they literally stole everything, even his underwear. So, I don't know, maybe there are some contemporary equivalents. But okay, the bond that Shields referred to was sometimes called the Black Bond, and it, as he says, it required all the subscribers both to keep the peace and not to aid or abet any of the field preachers or anyone else who's in trouble with the law, and also to swear that for their family and servants and their tenants if they were large landowners. In Lanarkshire, there were 2,900 heritors and fuars, which I think landowners would be the heritors, and fuars or something like sharecroppers, who were required to take the bond. Only 19 took it, until they were coerced by the means that we have described above. Shields mentions that all which the faithful chose rather to suffer. Burnett says, "All this was done so palpably to force a rebellion that the people saw through it, and bore the oppression more quietly than otherwise they would have done. But Duke Lauderdale's party was so sanguine in their hopes of fomenting one that they began to reckon upon confiscated lands." All right, so in fact, they weren't... The Duke and his co-conspirators were not just, you know, hoping to get small acreages and things like that, but rather they were hoping to get some rather large estates. Clearly, one of their intended victims was the Duke of Hamilton, which, you know, was quite a substantial estate. Burnett goes on to relate, let's see, what measures taken when that didn't work. "When this would not do, another expedient was tried. All the chief men of the country were summoned before a committee of the council and charged with many great crimes of which they were required to purge themselves by oath. Otherwise, they were to be proceeded against as guilty. It was in vain to repine at the illegality of this practice. Take the oath they must, or stand to the penalty of it. And so they all took it, nor did there appear, upon the strictest examination, one single circumstance of an intended insurrection. When all things failed, then they had recourse at last to a writ," okay, "which is also called the law bureau, "which a man who suspects another of ill designs against him may serve him with. This lies against the whole family, and the master is answerable if any of the household break it. So here, by a new and unheard of practice, this writ was served upon the whole country at the king's suit, and upon serving it, security was to be given, much like our binding men to their good behavior. Many were put in prison for refusing to give such security, and Duke Hamilton had intimation sent him that there was a design to proceed in the same manner against him. For what occasioned their suspicion and indignation against him was an accident that happened some time before. So Hamilton, although he wasn't any kind of strict covenanter by any means, he'd actually finally had enough of this sort of highly illegal legal proceedings. And this story is kind of interesting. Let's see. One Carstairs, a loose and vicious man who had wasted his estate and now got some money by procuring information against those who frequented conventicles. Right? They were offering rewards, so here's your chance if you're unscrupulous enough to make some money as a free agent. He decoyed Kirkton, an eminent preacher among them. Right? Let's see. Right, Burnett is, again, Episcopalian, but writing, at the time. So he decoyed Kirkton, actually got him to come into a house. El Kirkton was brother-in-law to Bailey of Jerviswood, a gentleman of great parts but of much greater virtue, into his lodgings. And there, under pretense of having a warrant to carry him to prison, endeavored to extort money from him and used him very roughly. Must be pretty hard up if you're trying to extort ministers for money. Bailey had information, especially ones that had been ejected from their office. Bailey had information of it, and he came to the rescue of his brother-in-law. As he came to the rescue of his brother-in-law, he heard him cry out, "Murder!" Whereupon he forced the door, drew his sword, made Carstairs, whom he found sitting upon him, come off, and then demanded to see the warrant, which the other refusing to show. He took Kirkton along with him, and so went away without the offer of any violence. Carstairs had, in truth, then no warrant. But before next council day, he procured one signed by 9 privy councillors and antedated. And it's that kind of, just one of the examples. I'll give you another one in a minute here. But when Bailey was cited before the council for making a riot, though he brought his witnesses to prove his behavior, they would not so much as examine them. But without liberty of making his defense, they fined him in the sum of £500 and condemned him to a year's imprisonment. Duke Hamilton and Lord Kincardine, who were then of the council, could not but argue against this method of proceeding as more like a court of inquisition than any legal government. And for this, they were turned out of the council as enemies to the church and as favorers of conventicles. Well, pretty clearly this guy Hamilton wasn't much of a favorer of conventicles if you'd seen all the things the Privy Council had done before. But anyways, he goes on to say, under these circumstances, Duke Hamilton had reason to suspect the worst. And therefore he and 10 or 12 of the nobility with about 50 gentlemen of equality went up to London to complain of all this. But the king refused to see them because they came out of their country in contempt of a proclamation. Though a proclamation, as they urged for themselves, when it hindered them from bringing their complaints to the king, was one of the greatest grievances they had to complain of. And while they were in London, Lauderdale summoned, I think it was a session of Parliament quickly, and voted through things that he couldn't have maybe got passed while they were here. So, another miscarriage of justice, which I don't plan to cover at great length, but I'll just mention it briefly, is you might remember that there was this Stickett minister, James Mitchell, who had fired a shot into Archbishop Sharp's carriage, and didn't hit Sharp, hit the other guy, wounded the other guy in the wrist, but. And 6 years later or something, Sharp was like walking down the street and recognized the guy and had him arrested. And he'd been in prison on the Bass Rock for a while. And about this time then they called him back for trial. And he had previously been, when he'd previously been to court, he was promised his life if he would confess. So he did. And then when they brought him back the second time, then they used his confession to convict. They also tortured him before with the boot, and all these driving these wedges into his leg with the iron boot previously. All right, that's part of how they made him confess in the first place. And then when they brought him back,
they use that confession against him. And this was another thing that some Hamilton and some other people objected to this thing, because they Sharp just perjured himself, and had the guy was executed. So Lauderdale said to have made the comment, "Well then, let him glorify God in the grass market." In other words, on the where he was executed, the center of Edinburgh. Okay, large conventicles went on through the year 1678 and was said to be the high point for field preaching. On the 1st through 3rd of June 1678, Welsh, Blackadder, Arnault, and Dixon preached and gave communion at a conventicle in communion season in Iron Grey Parish in Dumfries. 14,000 people were present. In September, Colonel Strother and the army requested additional troops to be sent to the borders in order to counteract Welsh's horse, or his cavalry troops. In other words, Welsh had his own armed bodyguard who was large enough that this guy from the army had to request additional troops. I think I mentioned this quote last week, but Dr. Matthew McHale, who I think was nephew of Hugh McHale, said at the time, "There is many a man in Galloway, if he hath but two cows, he will sell one cow for a pair of pistols." And on the 23rd of September, 1678, John Graham of Claverhouse was commissioned to command a troop of horse against the Covenanters. And if you've read any Covenanting literature, you'll know that he's one of the worst persecutors of the Covenanters. And his adventures and so on we'll get to next week or the week after. So I think we'll stop there and ask if there are any questions or comments. I was just going to say, Bruce, you must have something.
Well, when they were savaging this, the countryside, the Highlanders, what was it, a significant portion of the community that were being pillaged?
Yes, and included not just the Covenanters. I mean, included all kinds of people. I mean, the Duke of Hamilton apparently had great losses. I don't know, his tenants and so on. I don't know if they quartered anyone on him, himself, but on his estates.
So we assume that whatever revenue that would normally flow to England would be affected by all of this.
Well, yeah, except for they were collecting some of it.
I think the king might see a revenue decrease.
Yeah, you would think so. Yeah. I'm not sure he always thought through all the consequences to his actions. So, I mean, keep in mind they had all these extra troops in Scotland at the time, and they also were trying to exact extra taxes to pay for them. So they were trying to break even on this enterprise, but as you know, it didn't always work out for the one United States of America being case in point. So, Mr. Edmondson.
Prior to this, correct me if I'm missing details here, but the ministers get together in the time of the Jews to make the common cause. And there's passages in the Bible that speak upon it, and there's scriptures. So I mean, you see the same kind of deal today with evangelicals and Catholics together. It never appears that those, when people come together with that unity, because they seem to get some passages of the Bible, that unity is ever worth the point. It seems to me that this leads to trouble. Is that type of unity that seems to drive people together in the case of common enemy, they seem to get there and say, okay, that's the third difference
of the size and scale,
so
they can
it's never, and they usually
happen
a lot of people speak like
this.
It never seems like that works.
Well, it didn't, in the cases here, no, it didn't seem to work very well. That's right. It certainly, if we go back to the protesters and resolutioners, it's pretty clear that a number of the resolutioners were really, you know, they ended up being anti-Presbyterians. I mean, you know, Sharp being the archetypical example. So clearly when they went for the unity at that level, they ended up in sort of incorporating a lot of undesirables into the mix.
Can you have, really, when you have
Yeah, well, I think the plethora of denominations we have today sort of testifies to that. In fact, it's a very difficult thing. And
how far apart were they doctrinally? How far apart were they at this point, where you had the contemporaries and the ones who had taken the dogs? How far?
Well, some of them weren't, you know, they weren't very far apart, except for on this one issue that they had sort of caved, you know, those who'd taken the indulgence, many of them were just, had compromised on one issue, you know, and they took this on the issue of taking the indulgence. You keep in mind that the ones who took the indulgence had been ejected already, you know, and they were ejected not because they were ejected like somebody put their name down and therefore they were ejected. They were ejected because they refused to appear before the bishop and get his approval and, you know, and so on. So they, I'd say in one sense they doctrinally weren't that far apart, but they, for, you know, maybe for very sort of pragmatic reasons, like they wanted to keep feeding their family, they'd compromised.
Just remind me, what exactly did they promise to do?
Well, first of all, not to preach against the sort of errors of the times. You know, so they wouldn't preach against the king or about church government and so on. Although I'm not sure that was the only issue. The people who were opposed, Cameron and so on, thought that they actually, by taking the indulgence, I guess you could say under any terms at all, maybe even regardless of what the terms were, that these people had compromised Christ's authority over the church. You know, they were giving a sort of a false testimony that Christ really wasn't head of the church by taking the indulgence at all. And maybe from that critique, it may not have been extremely important exactly what the sort of promise they made. I mean, maybe if they made some other, you know, different promise. I don't know. But in that case, I mean, in the nature of the indulgence, they're promising not to preach against the, really against Charles or the church government he had imposed. And so, in that case, their compromise was pretty germane to what the issue was. Mike? Yeah, well, I think there probably isn't an analogy between them. I mean, it's obviously not exactly the same situation, but in one case, you have people making a compromise that they perhaps don't view as that big of a deal, and I'm sure the indulged ministers generally didn't go around saying, "I sin by taking the indulgence." You know, I'm sinning by taking the indulgence, but I'm going to keep taking it. Right? I'm sure they had their rationalizations for why it was okay to take it, and other people who wouldn't who would buy that. So. Okay, well, let's close in prayer. Alan, would you close?